This is Mike Valentine from the Strobance Cardiovascular Center at Centra in Lynchburg, Virginia, and currently incoming president of the American College of Cardiology. I'll be your host for the podcast series, Practice Made Perfect, a new featuring with in-depth conversations with experts on topics related to career and leadership development necessary for young cardiovascular professionals to succeed in the changing healthcare landscape. Join us as we explore these critical subjects of non-clinical competencies in the weeks to come.
We'd like to welcome everyone to the podcast on physician contracting. My name is Chad Hoyt. I'm a practicing cardiologist at Centra Strobance Heart and Vascular Center in Lynchburg, Virginia. I'm also the acting director of the Heart and Vascular Center. And I am pleased to be joined by my colleague, Jim Daniel, who is an accomplished healthcare attorney at Hancock, Daniel & Johnson. He's a real friend of the ACC, and I think we're all in for a treat. I will ask questions from a physician perspective, especially looking at it through the eyes of someone who's recently finished training or early in their career, and Jim's going to share a lot of his knowledge with us. So Jim, I'd like to start off with a real basic question. Do physicians even need to have attorneys look at their contract now? I mean, if you think about where they're getting contracts from, some of them are large sort of corporate hospital organizations, their academic centers, and they're given the contract and the administrator says, hey, there's no point getting an attorney, they're not going to change anything. So my question to you is, I'm a new physician, what should I do?
I mean, that's great, and I hope it doesn't sound self-serving, but it's hard to say you shouldn't have someone look at it, even if just to get an informed understanding of what you're being asked to sign. There's a reason these contracts are in writing. They're binding. You'll be held to the terms of those contracts. And to the extent you're looking for some certain expectations, the contract should mirror those expectations. There's a pretty standard rule, depending on, it's almost universal in all states, called the parole evidence rule. And once you have a written contract, all prior and contemporaneous discussions are merged in that contract. So the old expression is get it in writing. Once the contract is written, it really doesn't matter what you talked about on the front end. You're held to what's in the contract. Those prior verbal and contemporaneous discussions are determined to be merged into the contract. So I think it's important that just to make sure it reflects your understanding, that you have your eyes wide open over special terms that might affect on coming and going, that it's probably worthwhile to have it looked at. Maybe you can find somebody with some experience who works with people fresh out of fellowship who hope for long-term relationships so they cut you a break on what it costs.
I've been in physician contracting for about 20 years on the physician side, and I would say that even if the contract will not change, it's really important to understand what's in it, what the terms mean, and how you would dispute something if something came up. So I think that's an excellent piece of advice, Jim. So Jim, my next question is a very broad question, and we want to distill it down to the nectar for our younger physicians. But as I get a contract and I have it in my hands, what are the main components, not the minutia, but what are the main components that I need to know about and understand, and maybe the pitfalls as I review this?
Generalities are dangerous, but experience has taught me some provisions speak louder than others. So the ones that will affect you every day are your compensation, how it can go up and how it can go down. That'll affect you with every paycheck. There are some provisions that really don't affect you on the way in, they affect you on the way out. And it's important to get those straight on the way in. So for example, what's your notice? If your contract is 5 years, but it has a 30-day without cause provision, you really have a expectation that you could be let go at any time on 30 days. Most physicians don't come out of fellowship understanding this, but physicians are written on what's called a claims made basis generally in this country. And that means you have problems with things called tail policies. So once you leave your employer, if you're receiving your malpractice policy through your employer, those claims that come in after you've left are somebody's responsibility. And it typically requires an additional premium called a tail policy that you'd have to purchase to cover that. It's easy sometimes to get those if you ask for them on the way in. On the way out, it's difficult. Also, any kind of restriction, non-compete, those type of things may seem small on the way in, may be important on the way out.
That's excellent. So one little question that came up for us in the past is the issue of termination with cause and without cause. And so am I understanding correctly that if I'm terminated with cause, that's a black mark on my resume, that's a black mark on my future job opportunities. But if I'm terminated without cause, that protects me in a way. Am I thinking about that correctly or no? I mean, that's a question I think frequently comes up.
Yeah, again, a with cause termination means something went wrong that resulted in some type of behavior or conduct or policy or term breach that resulted in you being fired for cause. Usually the effect on the contract is less notice. You might get let go immediately for cause termination. I lost my license, I'm getting let go for cause. A without cause is typically a clean separation, meaning we typically, when we work with clients, for cause terminations can be litigated. You may have to prove to an independent third party like a judge or an arbitrator that there really was cause to terminate someone. A without cause avoids that, and so it's a cleaner separation, but you're also in a situation where you wouldn't want to have one that didn't have you with appropriate notice provisions. And when we work with employers, we typically recommend using the without cause termination to avoid the acrimony of a for cause termination.
And Jim, you've brokered a lot of deals and represented both hospitals and physician groups. What would you say the average length of notification a physician is required to give before turning in their resignation? What are you seeing out there?
So typically, the shortest I'll see is 30 days. The longest might be as much as 6 months, but that would be an outlier. For a physician to resign, most organizations, as long as they can arrange coverage, will let the physician resign. Better to have a physician who's left on good terms than one you're keeping beyond the period they want to stay. I'm usually more concerned on the other side, that the physician hasn't made the decision to resign. He or she has been asked to resign, and that's where the longer notice provision is important. It's usually cut both ways. If the employer can give notice on a certain term, it's usually turnabouts, fair play, that the employee has the same notice obligation. And if you're trying to arrange to move and have a new job, it'd be good to have paid through your last day and to have a period where you didn't have to provide services 90 days, something like
and
that.
And in terms of the absolute length of the contracts, are you seeing 1 year, 3 years, 5 years? I know that our initial contract, when we integrated with our health system in 2006, was a five-year contract, and then they've been 3 years ever since. What are the typical contract lengths you're seeing?
Right, so contracts vary. From a compliance perspective, there's a big concern that pay does not exceed fair market value. So some people will set the contract term short enough that they can revisit fair market value. Other people just have compensation resets in a contract that might continue on an evergreen basis for years and years and years. A typical term provision would be 2 to 3 years, but they might have automatic renewal provisions unless either side opts out. But you would expect some of the material terms to be subject to reset every 1 to 2 years.
Now, Jim, a lot of the physicians, if they're like me, when they're interviewing for a new position, they're offered contracts from both private and academic employers. Can you tell us in a nutshell some of the differences between a private practice physician contract and an academic contract?
Well, I'll try. So private practice falls into the independent physician-owned practice or the affiliated with the health system. Academic medical centers I see falling into two groups. One's where the physician has significant clinical responsibilities, almost like a private practice physician, and very little teaching. Ones that have significant teaching responsibilities and less expectation on the clinical. The more it's tied to teaching, the more I see a rote contract. Some academic medical centers even give two contracts, one for the clinical portion and one for the teaching portion. And sometimes they're paid through different tax IDs. One might be paid through the medical school, and one might be paid through the affiliated faculty practice plan. But they tend to be more rigid in their willingness to accept different terms. They tend to be tied to a school year, so the renewals or the without cause, some of them require you to recontract on a yearly basis with the school year when you're doing significant teaching. When you're with an academic medical center, but your role is really more of a community physician, the contracts tend to look more like a hospital-affiliated contract. In the private practice setting, we see group practices, which vary from a small group to a big group. Small groups generally customized to the relationship. The bigger groups tend to be more of a rote model, but still subject to specialty designations that make them different depending on, you know, which specialty you're practicing in. So for cardiology, have different terms than you expect for maybe neurosurgery or something like that.
Great. And let's shift gears a little bit to non-competes. So you hear a lot of debate about whether or not non-competes are enforceable. Can you give us an idea of what you're seeing out there and what your experience has shown?
This is part of the reason I think you should have your contract reviewed, because many of them these days have restrictive covenants, whether they're non-competes or non-solicits, some form of restrictive covenant. I often have physicians, particularly ones who are seeing their first contract, who've heard these things aren't enforceable. And typically they're not favored in the law, but if they're narrowly drafted, they are enforceable. This is a matter of state law, so depending on your state, there may be a restriction on enforceability, but non-competes that are reasonable are generally enforceable. Reasonableness is typically measured by three factors: geographic scope, scope of services, and duration. So one that kept you from having any type of job, whether or not it's competitive with your former employer, is probably overbroad. One that's for multiple years beyond a reasonable expectation is probably overbroad. And one that covers a geographic area that your former employer has no legitimate business interest in, for example, they don't get patients from, would likely be overbroad. So while these are subject to challenge, you're putting yourself in a position where you may have to make that challenge and incur the expense of doing so. That's why I would recommend you have those reviewed in advance so you know what you're getting into.
Okay, Jim, now dealing with non-academic positions, if you have a hospital employer, you can either be in an employed circumstance or you can be in a provider services agreement, a PSA. Can you tell us the differences?
Yeah, generally, going back in time 20 years, almost all medical staffs were voluntary medical staffs. Physicians were in private practice groups. Due to many of the market forces, many physicians have become employed by hospitals or affiliated brother-sister corporations of health systems. Those would make you generally considered a hospital employee, meaning you don't own your practice and your relationship is one of compensation to provide clinical services and maybe administrative and management services as well. A greater separation is sometimes achieved through a PSA model. In this case, you take a private group practice, and the health system, instead of contracting with the physicians directly as employees paid on a W-2, they would contract with the group and pay the group on a 1099 as an independent contractor basis. The group would then maintain most of its governance structure and would likely distribute funds through its existing comp model. And those relationships are intended to be a little more at arm's length as an independent contractor than you would expect a closer relationship in an employed model.
Now, Jim, next question. You know, you're the Johnny Cochran of healthcare law, and so we have physicians with variable levels of experience. And in clinical medicine, we cannot charge more for services when we're more experienced. And so therefore, there's a concept of fair market value. How does fair market value affect physician compensation for these physicians who are new to this and don't understand?
Yeah, so fair market value is a limitation largely driven by some of the regulatory laws. So for every federal law, there's almost a state counterpart. So I would speak federal and let you look at your state depending on where you are. There was a law passed called Stark. It's really the Ethics and Patient Self-Referral Act, named after Pete Stark, who was a congressman. It was based on a study that suggested physician ownership in clinical labs resulted in higher utilization of clinical lab services. In order to avoid having those services charged to Medicare and Medicaid, they put a limitation on financial relationships that a party can have if there's a referral of certain services. Those are known as designated health services. So if you work for a health system, you now have a financial relationship with the health system, and there's a limitation on the ability of paying you based on the volume or value of your referral of services to that hospital. And the limitation is fair market value. So you can't be paid in a manner that varies, for example, the number of tests you orders. Your total comp cannot exceed fair market value, and it would need to be a commercially reasonable arrangement. And this serves as a limitation in many circumstances on the pay that a physician can receive, because there's not a litmus test for fair market value, so you're trying to operate within broad parameters to be able to deal with large numbers of people. So it's rare that you can do a custom one-off FMV for every physician that works for an organization. And those FMV analysis are generally what sets the guideposts of the range in which physicians can be paid. And for the higher performing physicians, that may be a limitation on their total pay.
And Jim, just to finish, I think lastly and most importantly, contracts come in a lot of flavors. And I remember when we first started out in 2006 and integrated with our health system, it was all RVU based, 100% productivity, no quality, nothing really else. And now the market is shifting from a volume to value based reimbursement system, and hospitals are still being paid for RVUs and fee for service. And the transition's been somewhat clunky and awkward, but take us a little bit through the history of physician contracting. What are the main components that you see changing over time?
So we are in a period of transition, and I'll go back to, I started practicing in 1991. And at that point, we had the Health Security Act. Bill Clinton had asked his wife, Hillary, to prepare basically the first draft of the Affordable Care Act, and it didn't pass. But in order to prepare for that, many organizations began hiring physicians. And they put them on a salary model, expecting, honestly, to make money off the physicians, pay them a salary, and have some operating revenue. What they found is on a fixed salary model, many physicians began to reduce their productivity. I've seen surveys that suggest 20% drop in productivity when you went on a fixed salary model. To right that issue, many physicians were put on an RVU model, which pays you solely for clinical productivity. In a fee-for-service world, that's a great recipe, but it yields to rewarding physicians for higher acuity services, higher volume services, not necessarily better outcomes or better patient management. So we found out we overheated the machine a bit with the RVU model, and now we're trying to titrate it back to a situation where you're paying physicians to be productive, but you're recognizing productivity comes in more forms than just clinical work RVUs. So there's administrative time, management time, cost savings that's created, care coordination, working with your fellow specialists, telemedicine. There are a lot of ways that physicians should be rewarded other than RVU. RVU model was the dominant, probably still is, dominant method for compensation of specialists in employed models with health systems. We're seeing introducing alternative measures, small pieces at a time, 5, 10, 15, 20% of compensation. In some areas of the country, it's as high as 50%, but not most places.
Well, Jim, this has been extremely helpful. I know that as physicians, to have this distilled down to the to main points, it's extremely helpful. And I'd like to remind our listeners, if you want more detail and more beef, we have slides that are associated with this podcast. So please refer to them. And as always, Jim and I would be more than happy to answer any questions or inquiries that you might have.
This is Mike Valentine, host of the podcast series, Practice Made Perfect. Thanks for joining us today, and please remember to join us online at acc.org or wherever you get your podcasts, where you can find all the other episodes in this series. In addition, acc.org has additional tools and resources, such as slides and articles, which will help you navigate these complicated topics. They should be easy for you to find and easy for you to use. Thank you again.